You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Combination of physically tired and mentally tired. It's also tiresome, James.
It's. I was looking at that picture today, and I was actually going to tweet it absent any caption, just because it's a really good. It's a really good epitome of a lot of stuff. But I'm with you, man. I'm tired. It's Friday.
Who is it? Is that just some random Japanese guy?
I think it's. I actually think it's from a documentary about. I don't know if it's Africa, but.
Oh yes, yes.
It's there. Yeah. There's a little bit of a kind of like racy connotation there.
It's been long. It was interesting for me. We had Texas Energy Mining Summit here in Austin at the beginning of the week, sort of blended with Bitcoin Plus Plus. I was over at Bitcoin Plus Plus Wednesday and yesterday doing the live desk, and obviously topic of conversation is op return, this policy decision, this policy change that CORE wants to make, and many people are angry about. And it's just, again, it's also tiresome. I spoke with people on both sides over the 2 days, and I think I came away more confused than I entered the week. Like, what is the optimal path? And somebody who's worked on Bitcoin Core, for many years. I've seen you tweeting about it. Seems like, I won't put words in your mouth. I'll let you say, like, what is your perspective on this whole policy debate around op return?
Yeah. So in general, I think I have a somewhat different take than 99% of the people in the discussion, which is basically that this is a really stupid discussion. Everybody has mempool derangement syndrome, like at every layer. What frustrates me a little bit about the conversation, not to get grumpy right off the bat, but it's such a small issue in the grand scheme of challenges that are being presented to Bitcoin, that like spending all this drama on it is really a silly use of time and kind of emotion. But I can break it down for you. I mean, I think like, largely, the argument is happening on a few layers. The change itself, technically, I'm totally in favor of. It makes sense. You know, basically, the rationale is like, well, you know, people want to include exogenous data into the chain. You can't really stop them from doing that. And so let's basically minimize the damage by saying, hey, you know, we're going to make it easier for people to actually make use of op return as a data carrier, which lets us avoid bloat in the UTXO set, which is like one of the precious resources we have to take care of for the node. So that's all good. And the other thing too is that, as we've seen with the ordinal stuff, is you know, data is going to wait, make its way into the chain, and actually it hurts the whole network when there are transactions that most nodes haven't seen yet, but they come through a block. Basically, that slows down block propagation time. And so the whole idea is, if you bring policy closer to the actual consensus rules, closer to the actual transactions that are going to come through and be mined, then you're going to have better network performance. You're going to have lower latency when it comes to actually broadcasting a new block around. So that's like the sort of technical layer of the discussion. It's really a minute, non-controversial change if you kind of have fluency with the technical end of the mempool. But I think there's this higher layer to the conversation, which is sort of a re-adjudication of spam in Bitcoin. And it's, you know, I think a lot of the old animal spirits and sentiments are emerging about like, well, we don't like spam. And I think for a lot of people who kind of get lost in the technical details, it's very easy to latch on to the sentiment of I don't like spam. So that makes the sort of ocean knots camp maybe more appealing. So that's, yeah, that's, I guess, a summary. If you want to jump in anything in particular, we can.
That's what I was saying. I came out more confused than I went in. So last week on RHR, I agree, you want policy to be aligned with consensus. Like, whether we like it or not, these transactions are getting into blocks. They're non-standard, but they are valid within consensus rules. And policy just isn't aligning with that. And like you said, this is disrupting the P2P layer and potentially the fee estimation process that many nodes use, many applications use. And it makes sense to me to align policy with consensus. These things are happening, and if you can make it so Bitcoin full nodes are operating as efficiently and optimally as possible by changing this, it makes sense to me. I think my one pushback was makes sense to me. However, I think how it was communicated to people and the whole mess with the PR,
It's just a tactical error. Like, even if this change gets in, the real benefit of it is not material. You know, nobody was really clamoring for it. This stuff always, you know, gets the hackles up of everybody who cares at all about, you know, spam and Bitcoin. So it was a real tactical error. And I think that's one place where, I mean, it's kind of, I had a little bit of schadenfreude seeing it because I'm fairly critical of Core as a project along, you know, a variety of axes at this point. And it was just kind of a demonstration of the disconnection and kind of ineptitude of publicity management kind of on their end. And so there's part of me that enjoys seeing that because I'm kind of convinced that group has a lot less efficacy than they have credibility. And so to see that kind of catch up was interesting.
Let's dive into that. You said multiple axes, you have a problem. And I think we've throughout the years, we've been discussing the issues that Bitcoin, yourself, particularly as a Bitcoin Core developer for many years, trying to get things through, not only in the context of the way Core works from a governance structure, but just the way Bitcoin works as a distributed open source protocol, trying to get changes in. And I will say, having heard the perspective of Core developers like Gloria, Antoine, Insta Gibbs, throughout the week, I do have some empathy in the sense that it seems like there's many balls in the air, and it's just they want to focus on code and getting the stuff out, and the repositories become very political because of the people outside of it who are affected by the changes and have opinions. And I can see the argument that they may have opinions, but they may also not really understand the technical details of how all the stuff is interoperating with each other. And then I had conversations with Bitcoin Mechanic and Luke Dasher as well. And I think they do make good arguments in the sense of we have spam filters in email and we know it's not 100% effective, but it is effective to a degree. And if we sort of cater to these non-monetary use cases of Bitcoin to put arbitrary data in the blockchain by making it easier via increasing the op return limit, you're sort of going down the slippery path of signaling that we're okay with this. And frankly, as a user, as somebody who's been in Bitcoin for a while, the whole inscriptions ordinals thing, I don't think it's found product market fit. I would rather it be, and then you get into the subjective nature is what is a monetary use case of Bitcoin. And I've long been in the beginning of the inscriptions ordinal discussion, I was vehemently publicly voicing my disdain for that usage of Bitcoin. But over time it became clear if you just ignore them, it doesn't really have product market fit and it goes away. And so you have all these factors playing into how do you actually solve this problem?
Yeah, the irony is I don't think anybody in this conversation likes JPEGs on Bitcoin. You know, certainly none of the Core developers that I know do. I don't like that use, but I'm also sympathetic in terms of it being a provider of mining revenue when that's kind of sorely needed. But all that said, you know, the whole Mechanic Ocean bit about, well, email has spam filters. You got to be really, really careful when you're drawing technical analogies to Bitcoin. People do this all the time. You know, like even going back to the VHS Betamax analogy of Bitcoin and Ethereum, it's like, you know, you just can't, you can't draw an analogy. And the reason that that email analogy doesn't work is that, like, you know, your email inbox doesn't have to be reconciled with the global set of emails in order for you to get better email performance, in the same way that, you know, if your nodes or a miner's nodes mempool is out of sync with the incoming blocks, like that's going to meaningfully hurt performance. So there are some caveats to that analogy and most analogies that get drawn with Bitcoin. But do you want to go ahead and return to the core stuff and have me give my spiel there? So it's worth doing some throat clearing. You know, Antoine Gloria and all the sort of core contributors that are public at this point, you know, they're all smart people. I think they're all ostensibly like sort of well-intended. And obviously the development organizational problem in Bitcoin is a really hard one. It's one I wrote about a few months ago in that post, the consensus conundrum. And, you know, I think people forget that Bitcoin is as much like an experiment in technical human organization as it is like a, you know, as a sort of pure technology. And I think the under-acknowledged reality is that we had a much more hierarchical organization up until maybe 2018, 2019, well, maybe 2020, 2021, when all the CSW stuff started kicking off. But really, you know, we had essentially a small council of people who could make things happen within Bitcoin Core and therefore Bitcoin. And then that transitioned into this like sort of more freeform, you know, supposedly meritocratic, you know, leaderless structure. And since then, nothing really material has happened. That's not my beef. You know, my beef with the project, after having been a participant for maybe 10 years coming up this year, is that the things that are being focused on are kind of tangential or ancillary concerns. You know, honestly, anything concerning the mempool is somewhat of a secondary concern. It's very easy to make an argument about mining decentralization and, you know, the importance of having a relay network that isn't censored. I think there are a number of problems with the argument that that's like the biggest challenge facing Bitcoin right now. You know, anybody who's seen the inside of a mining operation knows or should know that the forces that are encouraging centralization in that function are not like mempool things. They're like logistical things. Like running a good mining operation is very, very hard. You know, keeping good luck, which, you know, luck is the score miners look at, which is essentially how efficient is my mining operation? You know, how well am I turning dollars into Bitcoin or energy into Bitcoin? And that's a really, really, really hard job. And so when you've got a model like full paper share that lets, you know, hashers offload luck onto other operations, and they just get to put in some hash rate and get out some Bitcoin fairly reliably, you know, that's like a, that's a centralizing factor. And so this emphasis that the mempool is somehow this like central factor controlling miner centralization is totally not the case as far as I can see. And there are much bigger fish to fry when it comes to making Bitcoin into, you know, the best substrate for peer-to-peer value transfer that we can. And, you know, I mean, as you know, I've been working on the Covenant stuff for a while. Jeremy's been working on the Covenant stuff for a while. And on the part of the core project as a whole, there's just very little interest or uptake in some of these major protocol issues that, you know, will actually help us remain decentralized.
Yeah, and that's been a common remark to this op-return drama over the last couple of weeks, is like it seemed like we were getting to a better spot in terms of the conversation around Covenant proposals, and then out of nowhere this comes up and causes a kerfuffle And it has a lot of people worried that, like, just this small policy change creating all this controversy, what does that do for the conversation around covenants, whether it's CTV? I believe you're interested in a check contract, Verify as well.
I like them all. Everything on the table, man, is a pretty well thought out proposal. You know, CTV, even CAT. I'm kind of holding off on pushing CAT because I know there are some higher level concerns there about, you know, MEV, which I don't think are well founded, but that's kind of another battle to fight. So coming out of OpNext, there was a huge amount of momentum around CTV and CheckSig from Stack, because if you I know you weren't there, but almost every presentation, whether it was about layer twos, vaults, Arc, BitVM, you know, every one of them was like, yeah, having CTV would be sort of a game changer for us. We'd love to have it. And so it seemed pretty clear there was good consensus coming out of that. You know, even among some of the active core developers that were there, I think it made an impression on them, like, oh, wow, okay, you know, we didn't really realize, like, to what extent there was demand for this thing. So there is good momentum for that. But that's kind of the irony of all this, is that many of the proposals that have been on the table, you know, are simple, safe, well fleshed out. People are just so accustomed to these giant changes like Taproot and SegWit, which, you know, like, I think the scale of those kinds of changes to consensus is probably over, just because there were such major, complicated, multifaceted, you know, engine lifts that, like, I don't think that's appropriate for Bitcoin in many ways anymore, those kinds of changes. And I don't think, you know, anybody really wants those. It's these more narrowly scoped, you know, opcode additions that I think would really move the needle and are much more easy to reason about.
Listen, freaks, I know you're tired of me talking about Fold, but I'm going to beat the drum. I'm going to beat the dead horse. If you're a Bitcoiner living in the United States and you're not using Fold, I'm just going to ask one question. What are you doing? You're leaving sats on the table. They've got gift cards. They've got their debit card. You can use your credit card. Just connect your credit card to the Fold app. Use the Fold app to pay off your credit card, and you're going to stack your credit card points and Bitcoin as well. They even teamed up with CrowdHealth to give their members Fold Plus membership at no cost. Don't leave sats on the table. Go sign up for Fold today. Go to tftc.io/fold. There's nothing to lose except sats that you could have stacked. Sup, freaks. This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at CoinKite. They make the Cold Card Q, my favorite hardware wallet, the most secure hardware wallet on the market. As you can see, it's got the BlackBerry form factor, full keyboard. It's got two secure enclaves. You create your private public keys offline. The device never has to go online, never does go online. So you keep your Bitcoin secure. If you have your Bitcoin on exchanges and you're looking to get it off, secure it in the best way possible. Pick up a Cold Card Q. Go to coinkite.com, find the Cold Card Q, use the code TFTC for 5% off. If you're a power user of Bitcoin, like I am, if you're running a business on a Bitcoin standard, if you're just a Bitcoiner who wants to secure your Bitcoin, get the most secure hardware wallet on the market, go get the Cold Card Q. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and I think in the case of CTV, I think it's been in the conversation for 7 years now, maybe longer, because I remember TFTC, we sponsored the lunch at the first CTV, like, developer meetup, I believe is in 2018, maybe 2019, but Jeremy's been beating this drum, and it's had its ups and downs in terms of the sort of engagement on the conversation around CTV. And, like, to your point, it does seem like this year, particularly with the advent of Arc, with Miniscript applications getting out there, and just basically the maturation of the second layer protocols, is getting to a point where it's like, hey, we have product market fit here. Obviously Arc, maybe not, but like Lightning and other aspects definitely have product market fit. And let's start looking ahead to how we can actually make it so this is as efficient and scalable as possible.
Yeah, 100%. That image of Jeremy naked in a cardboard box is seared into my brain from those early PlebFi meetings. But no, it's a tremendously well-studied opcode. I tried to avoid it when I was developing OpVault because of the drama at the time, the controversy. I said, okay, this thing is like so the branding of this thing is so hot right now. I have to try and, you know, work around that. And I wound up just poorly reinventing it. And so my collaborators at the time, AJ and InstaGibbs, were like, you should just adopt, you know, make CTV a prerequisite for the protocol. And that's something that I think everybody who goes through this process kind of comes to, is that CTV is just this like elemental tool that just keeps being rediscovered. And so, you know, it's definitely time for it, I think.
Well, for show's grown since we last talked, there's a lot of new Bitcoiners here. Let's put for like, what is CTV? What would it enable? And you brought up the magnitude of the changes that SegWit and Taproot were. Compare it. What is the magnitude comparison of CTV to those two?
Yeah. So, you know, when you spend a Bitcoin right now, basically what you're doing is providing a signature that proves that you can unlock essentially that Bitcoin for spending. And then it can go really anywhere. CTV is an example of something that, you know, is often referred to as a covenant. And basically all that means is that you're opening up the aspects of the transaction that are looked at to determine whether a spend can happen beyond just, you know, say the providing of a signature. So what this allows you to do specifically in the case of CTV is you can make a statement. When you own a coin, you can basically say, you know, this coin can only be spent so long as the transaction that it's being spent into looks like such and such. And so this allows you to encode basically these like big graphs of transactions that you can commit a coin to that are finite, because CTV isn't what's called like a recursive or a general covenant. But it basically allows you to, you know, sort of pre-sign, you know, a transaction to be spent through some flow without actually having to do pre-signed transactions, which have all kinds of problems. And so it turns out that this is really useful for a bunch of different things, including, you know, the thing that I know the most about is probably vaults. This is, you know, almost every layer 2 application has to structure these conditions where people in the layer 2 have to be able to get their coins out of the layer 2. And so that winds up being a use for CTV, where you're basically locking up the coin to be trustlessly, you know, redeemed in a certain way. It's useful for miners because they can compress payouts in the Coinbase using something called congestion control, which is nice.
We actually have a hackathon team right out here from the Bitcoin Plus hackathon that's going on today. They came over here to work on it. They're implementing CTV on testnet and doing this exact thing, like mining pool payouts from the Coinbase using CTV.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, that's great. It's a great application. And then there's the more general congestion control case, which I actually think is going to be really, really big in the future. It's going to be a really important use of CTV, because what it allows you to do is come up with a very concise on-chain commitment that allows redemption across, you know, hundreds, thousands of people later on at some point when the fee market is lower. And the reason that I think this is very important, and this is like a broader discussion, is that I think bank runs in Bitcoin are going to be a thing, whether it's some kind of a correlated layer 2 failure or whether it's institutional failure and people want to move coin around, they want to take possession of coin in short order. We're going to see these very spiky events in the same way that, you know, bank runs happen in traditional finance, in the same way that, you know, FTX goes down and all of a sudden everybody wants to take custody. And so I think congestion control is kind of an underhyped aspect of CTV that could be really important.
Yeah. And so with this in mind, let's just focus on CTV. What are your hopes that it actually gets merged? And let's put the Bitcoin dictator hat on. Like, how would you go about actually garnering consensus and then actually setting up a a soft fork mechanism to get it pushed through.
Yeah. So right now there are pull requests open against Core for both CTV and CheckSig from Stack, which activate it on reg test only. And so that means that we can get test coverage of it as we're running these automated tests that we have. And so those could be merged with really no risk. The thing is that CTV has been reviewed, like you said, for 7 years now, and the code really hasn't materially changed. I've, you know, changed a little bit of the window dressing on Jeremy's original patch. But the reality is that I think Lincoln Labs, no, not Lincoln Labs. I'm forgetting their name now, but somebody has had a 5BTC bounty on finding a material bug in CTV, and that hasn't been claimed yet. That's a lot of money at this point. It's $500,000. So CTV really is in a good place. I think it's seen the level of technical review. The situation that we now find ourselves in reveals this, you know, some of my other criticism of Core, which is that they occupy a place in the power structure of Bitcoin, in that Core is the de facto implementation that every business, every miner runs, because, you know, no business or miner really wants to take the operational risk of running something else. It's just, you know, it may actually come to that at some point, but for the time being, you know, if you're a serious commercial enterprise, you're running Bitcoin Core, because, you know, if there was some kind of a consensus failure and you were running some other piece of software, you'd look like an idiot. So de facto right now, Bitcoin Core has a kind of monopoly over like this protocol discussion. And because these are such deeply technical issues, most of the ecosystem, knowingly or not, cedes their assessment to the Core developers. Basically, it's very easy to say, well, if so-and-so doesn't, you know, if so-and-so hasn't acted, then it's obviously not ready for Bitcoin yet. And I think that sets us up for a very precarious, I mean, it's the situation that we found ourselves in for the last 4 or 5 years, which is that because covenants and protocol changes of this nature are a bit harder to think about. They require actual experience building applications. They require actual usage of script, which frankly, the sort of like Bitcoin Core class of developer hasn't experimented with. I know from personal experience, this used to be me before I started writing scripts, before I started working for custodians. You know, they just want to sort of focus on these pure software problems and these, you know, like closed form, you know, oh, let's figure out a new optimal way to restructure the mempool so that we can, you know, sort of hit some metric. That's a much easier space to occupy mentally than like, oh, what's actually going to, like, let's think about these big scaling problems. What's actually going to kind of move the protocol forward? So the uncomfortable position that we find ourselves in now in terms of activation for CTV is like the code's basically ready. The change has been picked over for years. There's a ton of demand for it. But because you haven't had many Core developers in a position where they can say, yeah, this is, you know, I understand this, I've looked at the code, it kind of jams the works up. Now, luckily, like I said, there were some Core developers at OpNext, and I do think that I should say, besides me, I'm still technically a Core developer, even though I'm kind of on the outs socially. But there were some Core developers at OpNext, and I think it's just becoming harder and harder to deny that it's time for this change. It's time to see a meaningful movement towards a soft fork, which again is just a tightening of the rules. It's not anything crazy.
What's up, freaks? Stop asking how to value Bitcoin. Start asking how to value everything else in Bitcoin. Unchained and Strive, Vivek Ramaswamy's asset management firm, just released a new report called Repricing the Economy in Bitcoin. It introduces a Bitcoin-denominated DCF model and shows what happens when you revalue equities like Apple using Bitcoin instead of dollars. This isn't just a thought experiment. It's a framework for capital allocation. Read it now at unchained.com/TFTC. That's unchained.com/TFTC.
The magnitude comparison to SegWit and Taproot, how big of a change is this from like how many lines of code and how
yeah
how so massive lines, of a consensus change different is it if at all? It's just an opcode.
Lines of code is it is mostly it's kind of the first metric that anybody looks at, and it's a you have to look at it. You know, the actual interpreter change. I think right now the CTV PR has 3,000 lines. The 90% of those are test changes. It's all these test vectors that have been added. I think the actual interpreter changes are maybe 200 or 300 lines. They're fairly minimal. Whereas Taproot, SegWit, you know, you're talking about thousands of lines of consensus critical code changed, excluding tests. And the other, I mean, the better way to size this up is SegWit and Taproot both changed these very core aspects. They changed the model for how script execution works in Bitcoin. You know, it's like a completely different system in some ways for how script gets executed. And with that, you know, there were resource changes. Obviously, SegWit added the discount. You know, Taproot introduced some resource constraint changes as well. You know, these are like system level changes. With all of the proposals that are on the table now, whether it's CAT, CTV, check contract verify, they're adding individual opcodes within the existing framework. And you know, I don't want to downplay the importance of vetting those and making sure that they're actually, you know, safe changes to make, because there can theoretically be, you know, you could think of it as contagion. If, let's say, you introduce an opcode that introduces some denial of service vector that can be exploited. Like, obviously, they need to be gauged for security, but they aren't these kind of like reimagining of the physics of how script in Bitcoin works. And so consequently, they're much easier to look at, I think, and assess.
Yeah. And I think that putting the perspective of the non-technical Bitcoin users sort of paying attention to what's happening to the protocol, I think many believe that SegWit and Taproot sort of enabled the combination of this to enable this inscriptions ordinals craze. And I think there's arguments for and against that. But I think there's a bit of PTSD in the sense of, all right, if we do another soft fork, are there some negative externalities in terms of stuff like that being enabled by these opcodes? And I think many are sort of just erring on the side of, let's not do anything because I don't want something like that to happen after something like OpsCTV gets merged in.
Yeah, 100%. And I understand that concern. It's one of those things that's just difficult to alleviate unless you kind of have a technical grounding in this, or you trust somebody who has a technical grounding in this and can tell you. The nice thing about CTV in particular is that, and this is really getting into the weeds here, but all of the verification that CTV does is based on SHA-256 hashing. And SHA-2 hashing is 1,000 times faster than ECDSA checks. I've got benchmarks that show this. So you still have to be careful, obviously, but you know, the DOS ability of something that's just hashing is a lot, you know, kind of less open-ended than something that's doing signature checks. And then for checksig from stack, it's literally the same operation as like a signature check. You know, that you would do. It's just allowing an arbitrary message in there. And so, all this stuff has to be looked at. And it's a perfectly worthwhile concern, but you know, the argument that I don't hear enough, you know, I watched the ossification debate, some of it last night with, Lisa and, Lop. I don't know if you caught that.
I missed it. I had to jump.
Okay. Yeah. But I think, you know, the recent beat that I've been on a little bit is trying to emphasize the risk of not doing anything to help scale Bitcoin. Because, you know, right now, if you run the numbers, just over, I think, 2.5% of Americans would be able to on a monthly basis, buy Bitcoin on an exchange, withdraw it to self-custody, and then maybe make a spend, you know, to pay their mortgage or whatever. That's a really, really low number if you're talking about actual usage of Bitcoin, actual ownership of UTXOs. And so if we don't figure out and by the way, Lightning doesn't help with this because you have to own a UTXO to, you know, participate in Lightning, and you have to have the threat of actually hitting the main chain to close your channel if your counterparty tries to cheat you. So, you know, I think a lot of people, myself included for a long time, kind of have this feeling in the back of their mind that, like, either we've got the scaling solutions that are going to kind of let Bitcoin remain this decentralized, trustless value layer, or, you know, some genius is going to come along and figure out a way to preserve that given the existing system. And after years of thinking about this, I just don't think that that's true right now. And I think the risk of us stopping, especially given the increased, you know, scrutiny that things like the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve introduce, you know, I think there's a shot clock basically on getting to a truly trustless, decentralized value storage technology. And I think we really have to be thinking about that.
I agree. And the panel yesterday, the core developers, Peter, Gloria, Antoine, and Greg, I think it became clear to me there is like PTSD within core too. I mean, Peter specifically was like, I don't want anything to do with soft fork activation.
Yeah.
I'm staying out of it. And I think that we need to somehow get over the PTSD there. I don't know if it was Craig Wright driven or just the backlash of Inscription's ordinals emerging after Taproot and SegWit. But I think enough time has passed. It's like, all right, if we believe that we want CTV covenants to scale Bitcoin for individual self-custody purposes, if you think that's worthwhile, which I certainly do, we sort of have to just like shake off the PTSD and start having genuine conversations about this. And maybe this show's drifted more towards the macroeconomic and sort of sociological aspects of Bitcoin. We try to keep it technical as often as possible, but I'll admit we've gotten away from it. Maybe it's on the part of the greater Bitcoin community to make some noise about this too. That gets into the question, all right, once you shake off the PTSD, like, what is the activation route if we think it's worthwhile?
It's understandable, man, because like the technical weeds just get deeper and deeper, and this stuff just gets harder and harder to reason about. And I think with all the exciting geopolitical stuff that's going on, you know, number go up big time, that's a lot more fun and interesting in some cases to talk about than these hard questions of like, okay, well, how do we actually make this thing deliver on value storage? So I don't follow you at all for not really like focusing on, because God, I mean, if I wasn't a software engineer, like my eyes would glaze over if somebody was describing CTV to me, because it's such an indirect, like bizarre, you know, you're like, well, but how the hell does that? Yeah, that's not useful at all. You know, it doesn't viscerally make any sense. And it doesn't really have the Blockstream marketing, you know, machine behind it, which, you know, for SegWit and Taproot, I think did a very good job of getting people riled up and saying, oh, privacy, 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 and efficiency of Schnorr signatures and, you know, things like that. Since then, there hasn't really been that kind of like, you know, you could call it marketing, you could call it consent manufacturing, which I think is inevitable when things are this technical. But yeah, man, we have to shake off the stasis, and we have to figure out what a workable arrangement is going forward. I mean, I think at some point Bitcoin has to stop changing. I am for ossification at a certain point, and I think it'll be inevitable. I just think that the external forces of ossification are coming more quickly than I would have thought, and the downsides of ossification are greater than I would have thought
in the current state. The downsides.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So hopefully, I mean, I was really blackpilled for 2 years, maybe, coming out of this. But the last few months, I think we have seen momentum around some of these proposals, and we've seen a lot of non-core developers in the ecosystem who are, frankly, just as smart, you know, and capable as the core developers. I really don't think the core devs deserve this this kind of high status, this glazing. Like, it's really kind of distasteful to me, because, like, they're all well-paid. We're all well-paid, you know, for the most part. And there's plenty of money out there for core devs. But these, you know, people in the ecosystem working on actual applications are like, what the hell's going on, man? Like, we've been hearing about CTV for years, and it, you know, we can see firsthand it'd be really useful for these, like, you know, very Bitcoin values aligned projects we're working on. You know, I mean, like, one of my favorite advocates who's been vocal for some of this stuff is Rob Hamilton. You know, Rob is doing one of the most interesting things, you know, for the sort of traditional Bitcoin use case that you can think of, which is, you know, in essence, he's trying to de-risk custody. You know, he's offering an insurance product that insulates people from loss. And, you know, I think he's really activated in the last year, because he's like, I mean, you know, I'd love to make use of this stuff, and it all seems safe. So I do think there's kind of a growing awareness that we do need to keep moving forward. How it happens remains to be seen.
Yeah. Rob's right outside here. I actually asked him a couple questions. Like, what should we ask you right before before I hopped in here? I completely, and I'm optimistic too. It did seem like for the longest time, the covenant discussion, I think the way the Taproot Wizards guys with the Opcat specifically sort of marketed it and came very aggressive with that particular covenant proposal, really just people like step back. Like, there was the social aspect of, you guys are degenerate scammers and we don't want to associate any update with you. But I think cooler heads have prevailed. And again, going back to CTV, I think CTV has been discussed for the longest, has been tested the longest, and it would make sense to me that may be the one we should focus on for focusing on covenants. But then you have the discussion of, like, if you do one, how many do you do more at the same time if you're going to do a soft fork? So check sig from stack, any prev out, it's been talked about. So it's like, you have to, like, there's many layers to this discussion. Like, if we're going to do one, should we do more? If we're going to do more, how many do we do?
Yeah, I actually think, you know, you have to look back in time at the soft forks that preceded Lightning, which were Check Lock Time, Verify Check Sequence, Verify, obviously SegWit. You know, those first two just rolled out without much fanfare, and they were much closer to the kinds of changes that we're talking about now, in that they were just basically adding opcodes. There was a little bit of, you know, transaction logic in there, but I would really like to see us kind of get back to that. I don't think it's really a good thing to be doing in terms of this giant bundling, you know, because that kind of risks, like, this omnibus type situation, which are fair criticisms of SegWit and Taproot, and that's partially why the, you know, I think the changes in both of those were completely reasonable, aside from some minor nits on Taproot. But, you know, I don't want to see us get into this position where we're, you know, lumping a bunch of changes together. I think the actual deployment of soft forks nowadays would be a lot, you know, smoother than they were back then, because things just generally seem to be less contentious. But also, I'm, you know, I think, again, a lot is made of, like, the severity of chain splits, and I just think there's a ton of FUD when it comes to the actual deployment of these things that I think the negative consequences of, like, whatever, you know, honestly, seeing a 5-block reorg would probably be good for the ecosystem. That would probably be a good thing long term to stress test some of these systems. So I think, you know, we can roll out soft forks. That seems like a pretty easy problem. We should be cautious about, like, bundling them all together. And I just want to make one note on the Taproot Wizards guys. You know, I think they deserve, let me just say this, you know, I know those guys very well. I have for a long time. I think in the fullness of time, it will be clear that they really do care about Bitcoin. And everything that they do is to the end of trying to make Bitcoin succeed. You know, mostly on the terms that I think are widely shared, the values that are widely shared. I think that, you know, those guys are just kind of avant-garde type artist guys, and they like being, you know, controversial and confrontational. So they have their own style. And I think, you know, there's something to appreciate about that, even if aesthetically, like, look, we all hate spam and garbage for the most part. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they do like JPEGs, but I think they're kind of in it for the right reasons, more or less. They're not just trying to spam the chain with JPEGs.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's what I'm curious. Like, Ben Carman, now he's at Spiral. I was saying, why'd you leave? We asked him last week. He said they stopped working on OpCat. Like, why'd they stop working on OpCat? Which is interesting, but we don't have to belabor that point.
I think there's a lot going on there, and I think they haven't lost interest. You know, while we're here, let me just give my big selling point for OpCat, because I still hate OpCat. I hated it when it came out. I was very critical.
I interviewed Polstra on Wednesday. He's like, OpCat's my baby. Like, he's really, yes, like,
on he it. Loves it. And I get his rationale, and I agree with it. I totally agree with it, because here's the thing. So OpCat, you know, my old bit from years ago was that basically OpCat is like building a computer out of black and white pebbles. Like, yeah, you can do it. It's horrible. But it lets you do pretty much, you know, anything you need to do. And I think as we look at how the how uncertain the technical waters are for Bitcoin in terms of our ability to actually make changes, having OpCat is really important as this hyper inefficient escape hatch to do things like, you know, zero knowledge proofs. I think people forget that in the early days, Satoshi, Greg Maxwell, a lot of the early guys were like, you know, look, ultimately, we want to move a lot of this stuff towards zero knowledge proofs because it's a really cool tech. It's just not mature enough to put on the base layer. But like, this might be our best shot at privacy, freedom, all this stuff. So the thing that's appealing to me about OpCat is that it gives us this little escape hatch to experiment with things like zero knowledge proof rollups that are completely values aligned with Bitcoin and may actually wind up being, you know, some of the techniques that like bail us out from a freedom standpoint. But it's inefficient enough that it's not a major change to Bitcoin. And to do anything on there requires like a lot of money spent as revenue towards miners. So the other big problem, as almost everybody knows, is that the subsidy is dwindling right now. It's a little over 3 Bitcoin. You know, soon it's going to be 1.5, you know, after that, fractional. And that, you know, if the net security spend behind Bitcoin is very low in 10 years, like that's not a good outcome for the system, because it's all predicated on, you know, there being a ton of security spend, you know, a ton of thermodynamic security behind the system protecting it. And so I like OpCat because it's basically a way of doing, you know, almost anything, but having that inefficiency subsidizing miners. I know there's a whole MEV discussion there. I have been convinced, I was very skeptical about that for a long time. I've been convinced that's not actually a concern, because if you look at the way that MEV works, the 10-minute block time basically makes like layer one DeFi shit kind of intractable and unappealing. And so what winds up happening, I guess, is that a lot of the MEV gets moved up into these like layer two sequencers, and then that's where a lot of the messing around happens. And so I actually think, because of things like, you know, script limits, because of the 10-minute block time, all of these, you know, kind of vague pieces of doubt about CAT and its, you know, risks, I think are not as well founded as I had thought. But, you know, to the broader discussion, I think setting that aside, you know, to evaluate on a longer, you know, time scale makes sense. Whereas changes like CTV, checksig from stack, like these are just like open and shut, you know, very basic, very well understood, scrutinized. You know, I spent a bunch of time trying to break CDB. At a certain point, Jeremy had made some caching change that was a result of some benchmarking that I had done. And it turned out my benchmarking was wrong and CTV was fine, you know, to begin with. So a lot of people have been trying to break those and can't. Cat's a little bit of a different discussion.
Let's paint the picture. I mean, you've described what it would enable, but like, how more confident in Bitcoin would you be if, let's just focus on CTV, check sig from stack, if they got soft forked into Bitcoin?
I think it would do really nice things for some layer twos. You know, Arc specifically, it reduces the need for interactivity. I think in Arc, you can then non-interactively receive value, which is big. Obviously for vaults, you know, vaults are kind of a separate question from scaling. In fact, vaults are kind of like opposite of scaling because they require more chain use. But if the chain is a ghost town and we're not getting any fees, then vaults are actually great because they're gonna juice miners with some fees. So CTV does get you a fairly primitive form of vaulting that I can say would probably be used at the industrial level. Still maybe not ready for like home user, personal user type vaults. We're still not at that level of ergonomics with just CTV. But the important thing to note is that CTV is basically required for any kind of good vaulting. You know, again, when I was coming up with Op Vault, it just wound up being kind of a prerequisite unintentionally. So, you know, those things are really good. I think congestion control is big. My big worry about Bitcoin is that we're going to have some kind of phase change event where either it's a regulatory discontinuity where the government comes in and says, hey, if you're a regulated miner exchange, you know, you've got a soft fork in monetary policy tools where this is going to go into effect at such and such date. And, you know, with the knowledge that Bitcoin, given its current capacity, can't possibly facilitate all the withdrawals. So I think having something like CTV and having, you know, exchange level support for congestion control where it's like, hey, you're an exchange. If I'm going to put my Bitcoin in you, I want to be able to see that you can actually compress, you know, an arbitrary number of withdrawals into this 132-byte hash and put it on a chain. I think that's really important. And that would make me feel a lot better about that kind of exit case. You know, and then even I haven't really looked into applying that same sort of congestion control exit into... I should say Arc already uses that pattern. That's basically how a unilateral exit works in Arc, is that, you know, you spend this one output and then the users of the Arc have to unroll that output. I think what's interesting about that is that and with all these layer twos, and that's why I've started thinking about the block size, which is a whole other discussion we can get into if you want. But you know, Greg Sanders did a really good talk at OpNext about the economics of some of these layer two systems, because to really have a trustless layer two system, you've always got to be able to unilaterally withdraw your coins to the base chain, right? Otherwise, you're just stuck in somebody else's system. In the Arc case, you know, unrolling this tree, there are a few layers in the tree. That means that, you know, you as a user of the Arc potentially have to see a number of transactions broadcast and committed on chain to actually get your value out. And so, you know, how much does that cost? What's the weight of those transactions? You know, what's the fee regime look like? Those are really interesting questions that, you know, are not well spelled out. They're not well modeled by these VC-backed companies that are making this Arc system. Like, what I worry about here is, and I really don't mean to pick on Lightning too much. Lightning's a great technology, smart people working on it, so on and so forth. The amount of venture capital and hype relative to our expectations for Lightning, you know, 7 years ago, I think it's non-controversial to say that hasn't been met. You know, like, we all kind of, I think, thought in the back of our minds back in, you know, 2018, 2019, Lightning is going to be the thing that scales Bitcoin, and we're all going to be using Lightning wallets. Some of us are, but it really hasn't delivered on that for a lot of these kind of thorny well, you've got to manage directional liquidity. You know, you've got to, oh, gee, when the fee market spikes, all the channels close, you know, which exacerbates the situation. There are all these like second order things you got to think about with the layer twos. And until we've got a working layer two that is meaningfully scaling Bitcoin, I think we kind of have to be cautious about assuming that's coming down the pike.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I use Lightning every day. I think I would say it probably has not reached the expectations that we thought. Like, everybody's going to be using it. I was talking to Corallo yesterday. He's confident that the back half of the year we'll see self-custodial Lightning will take a step, will make a step function improvement.
No, for what reason?
I don't know. He made an announcement of announcement on the live desk.
Basically. I'm tired of these things, man. We need social norms against announcement of announcements.
I believe me, I pushed back. I was like, you're making an announcement of announcement on the show.
Yeah, I'll believe it when I see it, man.
Yeah. But I think I don't know if this was ever the intent out of the gate, but I think Lightning is finding this really nice product market fit as this connective tissue between these second layer solutions, whether it's eCash, Mints, Arc. And
100%.
I think there's a lot of value there.
Institutions, exchanges, you know, I completely agree. I think it's invaluable for that. I just think we all kind of thought it would be this, it would be the thing that onboarded more normal people to Bitcoin and facilitated more kind of payment activity. But,
well,
you know, part of the problem is there isn't demand for payments in Bitcoin.
Yeah. And like, that's, I guess that gets to, which is below that, which is like how many people are actually adopting Bitcoin.
I know. And that's sort of the problem at the root of all this, you know, the best objection that you can give to a lot of the stuff that I've been talking about recently is like, people just don't care. People just don't care about self-custodial Bitcoin at this point, actually using Bitcoin at this point. So my argument is, as an engineer, you know, think about building a bridge, right? Say you live between two cities, you know, one city's on the mainland, the other city's on the island, right? And right now, like, there's only a little bit of traffic in between these cities. So you're an engineer, you want to build a bridge, right? You know, one option is to build the bridge for the amount of capacity that's, you know, going across right now. As an engineer, it's very appealing and maybe even your duty to project forward and say, hey, in 10 years, 20 years, like, how many cars were you expecting to go over this bridge? You know, if there's a disaster on one side of the bridge, in fact, like if there's a disaster that we all kind of see coming and there's a credible argument that there's going to be a huge spike in traffic. Well, you know, we should be designing the bridge to kind of withstand that, that load. So anyway, just as an engineer, I can't help but forward project.
No, and I think it's important to do that. And I think it's become clear that individual adoption of Bitcoin, even as a savings vehicle before a payments vehicle, is not happening as quick. I mean, Daniel Krawitz wrote Hyper Bitcoinization in, what, 2013? Like, I think we all, like, when I first got in, I was like, FOMO, it's happening. We need to get in. Everybody's going to get this. And I think throughout time, we're all learning that this asymmetric information that's held by Bitcoiners, understanding how it works compared to the incumbent monetary system, is not moving throughout the world as quickly as we expected. But I think it also affords us an incredible opportunity to build these bridges before the hordes are forced to use Bitcoin in the future.
Yeah. Hey, question for you, just as an aside. How worried are you about the process of Bitcoin becoming like sort of a stock ticker, like the ETF ownership, you know, the concentration in custodians? Like, how much does that kind of keep you up at night? Or do you think there's going to be a sort of, you know, business application level solve for that?
It doesn't keep me up at night because I hold my Bitcoin in cold storage, and I fall back to the Bitcoin's for enemies. If people want to put it in an ETF wrapper, MicroStrategy wants to hold it at Coinbase, they can do that. It doesn't affect me as long as I have the ability to self-sovereignly use Bitcoin in a P2P matter and custody it myself.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
good. And I mean, I do think number go up by any means is good for like better liquidity profiles, good for anybody using Bitcoin. But And I just conversations I have with normies in my life. I shouldn't call them normies. People in my life that are not into Bitcoin. Like they just view it as a stock ticker and a stock ticker. And I know, I think we're just at this very early stage of Bitcoin where people haven't even questioned money to begin with. They're starting to post COVID. But yeah, I'm actually interested to see if something, if we have like a black swan adoption event from the machines that really highlights that Bitcoin as a medium of exchange actually works and is viable.
Well, here's what freaks me out a little bit. Just kind of thinking through the high degree of institutional ownership now is like, if we did see a contentious, say the G7 countries, you know, say Bitcoin, whatever, 5x's, 10x's from here, the G7 countries get together and they're like, okay, great. Wow. We're going to rebase our monetary system on this thing, maybe partially or whatever. But we just need our monetary policy tools back a little bit. We just need a little bit of a tail emission or whatever. What freaks me out is if you've got, you know, Sailor owning 500,000 coins or whatever, and, you know, BlackRock owning however many, it's the situation where like that concentrated ownership can act very decisively in a situation where a fork happens, they dump the other side of it, and then profit seeking miners just have to flip. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I kind of worry about that.
Well, in the case of Sailor, I mean, his whole shtick is there's only ever going to be 21 million, right? Like, and so India of the government.
Yeah, but did you see the BlackRock promo video where they asterisk that?
Well, I think they have to for legal reasons, right? It is highly unlikely, but possible, technically. But I wouldn't be surprised. And yeah, it is, and it's certainly like adversarial cap on now. Yes, something we should worry about. And I think we just need, and I do think I like what the guys at Zaprite are doing in the sense of just like enabling people to easily accept Bitcoin as payment as a business and inject their self-custodial options.
Yes. Yes.
And I don't know. I think it's a learning process. I mean, this has been said many times throughout the years, on this show, which is like before we had plumbing, people had to learn how to wipe their ass and take showers. Like, I think people are just learning how to wipe their ass and take showers when it comes to private public key management. And something like, if something like CTV or Vault down the road and what Rob's working on, what he's doing at Miniscript, I mean, that's already on the market. But if we can enhance use cases like that, I mean, your whole pitch for OpVault, let's make exchanges unhackable. And if you can apply that to self-custody as well, I think the degree to which people will be more comfortable self-custodying Bitcoin will increase significantly and really defease that risk in the long term.
I think one of the most exciting things about vaults, and I don't think this is widely understood, so I'm glad I'm on here, able to talk about it, is one of the reasons I'm so excited about vaults. It's not, you know, that I've seen custodians and we can, you know, make their operations more efficient. It's that I believe vaults are a tool that would allow you to actually onboard someone with nothing more than a cell phone and maybe an account and an exchange and be able to get a degree of self-custodial security that's on par or greater than, like, you know, setting up a hardware wallet and burying a seed phrase in your backyard. Because you can do something where if you set up sort of the time delay for a spend on a vault, you know, and obviously your wallet can have different delays and so forth, but you could have a configuration on your phone where someone can have a key on their phone. They can be receiving Bitcoin, you know, spending it in different thresholds. And then if that key ever gets compromised and, you know, the phone's watchtower can't check in, or, you know, the exchange's watchtower can't check in or whatever, the funds get swept to their exchange account. Or, you know, perhaps if it's your mom, you know, maybe you configure it in such a way that there's a watchtower on your cell phone. And if you see the funds move, you know, your mom's life savings or whatever, you call her up. No, I didn't move those. You click a big red button and then it gets swept to your exchange account. So even if the attacker, whatever, got all of your parents' credentials, say, you know, so there's all kinds of things you can do. I mean, there's just an infinite number of ways you can nest the scripts. with something like a vault to make a really, really ironclad self-custodial setup that you don't need special hardware for. You may not even need a seed phrase setup process, you know, in some cases. You might want one, of course. I'm a big fan of seed phrases, but if you're literally just trying to onboard your cousin with $1,000 of Bitcoin or something, you know, and he's got an exchange account, you can say, hey, you can hold this yourself, you know, without the custodian having access to it. But still, you know, if you see some funky behavior or get hacked or whatever, you know, leverage the security of the custodian. So to me, that's really exciting.
Yeah, it is. And I'm just thinking about a use case, and got beers with one of the dads at the boys' schools a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about Bitcoin. I showed him how to download Blue Wallet. He went through that process, and then he texted me this week. He's like, how do I buy more Bitcoin on this Blue Wallet? And I was like, you don't buy it there. Set up an exchange. And like, even that, like, even I sent him some exchanges, reputable exchanges you can buy Bitcoin through. And even there, in the back of my mind, I was like, do I really want him sending this to Blue Wallet? Do I need to have like another conversation about like how to secure the seed phrase and what, like, the OPSEC around securing your private keys? And if we can make it so you don't even have to have that conversation, it'd be incredible.
Absolutely. You could even set up like training wheels. You could say, hey man, okay, right now your vault has a condition where, you know, if I detect some weirdness, I can sweep it to your exchange or my exchange or whatever, but we can rotate you out of that trivially. Like we can remove that policy. You know, you could do all kinds of things like that. And I think, you know, exchanges who are Bitcoin aligned, you know, like River and NYDIG and others, you know, they of course have an incentive to offer this kind of wallet, because like you're saying, it's like they, you know, if they can integrate the actual purchase of Bitcoin with some kind of self-custodial option, it's a win-win for them because they don't have to custody the Bitcoin. They get to make their spread. And then that would, you know, they'd be a natural counterparty to run a watchtower and to be a backup. So it's a really, really cool design. I'm really excited about the prospect of it coming to Bitcoin. You know, CTV will get us a lot of the way there. It'll get us, you know, some of the functionality, but to really get the full vision, this check contract verify opcode, which thank God is very simple. And I think, you know, once more people start looking at it, will be an appealing target for a future software.
Let's talk about that a little bit before we wrap up here. So Salvatore from Ledger is on top of this, right?
Yeah. So he and I have been going back and forth for a little while. It's kind of a confusing progression because he started off doing this Matt thing, and it eventually morphed into Check Contract Verify. And we went back and forth for maybe 3 years because I had done Vault, and he was like, no, I think this Check Contract Verify code is really cool. I think you can do Vault stuff. And I'm like, I don't see it. Like, well, how do you do this thing? How do you combine these Vault inputs? How do you do this amount balancing? And he's like, okay, well, I'll make this change. I'll make that change. And pretty soon the proposals in a way kind of morphed, like kind of melded together. And he did a really, really good job of making CCV into a very general kind of embodiment of AJ Towns's Tapleaf update verify idea, which never really got a formal implementation or proposal. But anyway, like so what Salvatore has done with CCV is it's basically just a way of saying, hey, I'm going to make an assertion about how the tap tree is changing through spends. And again, if I'm a normal person, my eyes are glazing over at that point. What the hell does that mean? It's pretty hard to explain, but the point is that it's a very fairly simple Bitcoin cryptographic operation to enforce. And it's a very general tool that, you know, allows you to make these really ergonomic vaults and to do other things. You know, so I think that's a super exciting proposal. It's a little bit tough to get your arms around, but luckily the implementation is very simple. You know, the line of code added, pretty minimal. So I'm very bullish on the prospect of that making some progress.
All right, I'm going to beat the drum. How do we, dictator hat on, how do we do this? How do we build consensus? How do we activate? How do we get the conversation out of the stasis phase? Does there need to be olive branches extended between core developers who don't agree what they're doing? Does there need to be a big
I want to say Bretton Woods of Bitcoin, but like something
Well, you know, Bitcoin is money for enemies. And, you know, in keeping with that, I've tried to be a little bit of a heel lately because I think this like kumbaya Bitcoin core situation is really not a good configuration for Bitcoin, for the reason that if Bitcoin's technical success is contingent on this one organization and this one code base, you know, like working harmoniously together, like they're already a choke point, man. I mean, they like if they are not already captured, like that is a great target for sabotage because de facto changes go through there. So to your question, you know, my goal here, I think, is to put pressure on that organization either to catalyze the review of this stuff and take it seriously or set up the kind of social rationale for saying, hey, we're going to like we're forking, we're going to do an alternate activation client, because we're getting to the point here where I think you could get together a very compelling group of people who have public credibility, who are building interesting things, and basically get them to say, hey, if this doesn't get real attention within 6 months, if there isn't substantive review discussion about how we get this stuff in, you know, we're going to start looking at an alternate client, because at a certain point, the lack of attention becomes kind of indistinguishable from an attack. And so that's, I think that's my current path. I think long term, the reason I'm leaning into that kind of adversarial mindset is because, again, it's just not a good situation for Bitcoin to be in where everything has to sort of come together at this central point. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And again, I would go back to what I was saying earlier with empathy, because I feel like everybody's so shell-shocked that they don't. I think they have soft fork fatigue almost, where they don't want to the gravity of even approaching the subject of soft forks is such where nobody wants to really stick their head out and do it. And so they're focusing on policy and mempool and stuff like that.
Yeah. And to be clear, I don't think they're attacking Bitcoin. Yes. I mean, like there's one part of me in the abstract that says, well, this is such an important system that it would be naive to think that state actors weren't somehow participating in the process. But on the other hand, I know all these people personally pretty well, and they all seem well-intended to me. It's just that we find ourselves in this very uncomfortable, un-Bitcoin-like situation, and we got to get out of it. Like, there's got to be a way to get out of it, because otherwise, there's literally centralization going on. And, you know, one of the things that frustrates me about Core a little bit is that out of one side of their mouths, they say, oh, it's so irresponsible to run a consensus engine that isn't Core. But then the other side of their mouth is saying, oh, well, you know, hey, it's not our job to evaluate these controversial things. And it's like, well, look, man, the substance is in the controversy. Like, to make substantial progress here, there's going to be controversy. If a trivial issue like, you know, this mempool filters thing, which doesn't actually really mean anything in any sense, it's sort of a virtue proxy for people to express their values. Like, the consensus stuff is going to be controversial. And so, you know, simultaneously occupying that part of the power structure and all the attendant funding and, you know, like, but not owning it and not saying, okay, we do have to reckon with this, you know, or, you know, saying, hey, some of us are going to split off and like do another implementation. You know, it's just this position can't kind of continue to the benefit of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But it's a tough one.
It's a tough one. It's like, yeah, it is weird. Like, you think of like Chain Code, Brink, OpenSats, like funding all these devs. Like, dude, but it's always like no strings attached. Work on what you want to. So I was gonna say, like, you have to go to Alex and Suhas to be like, guys, come on, what are we doing here? You have to go to,
like, you know, and I've worked for. I mean, they don't. They would not. They would never, there's never a conversation like that.
That's the point I'm trying to make. It's like,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. But at the same time, you simply can't ignore that there is a social reality to being in that world. There are people who decide, does this person get funding or not? And on what basis, you know, and that set of people's pretty limited. You know, there are really three organizations that do, maybe four, that do a bunch of core development funding. And you know, I'm involved with OpenSats. I think OpenSats may or may not have it's been an informal policy in the past, but like they haven't liked to fund people working on consensus stuff. because it's controversial, which to me, like, we're going to need to revise, because, you know, the important stuff in Bitcoin, the stuff that's going to guarantee Bitcoin's success, is at the consensus layer at this point. So it's got to be grappled with. So it's a messy situation. I think everybody involved, to my knowledge, has good intent. But we just have to think about how to reframe the system to continue under more kind of, you know, under bigger stakes, more adversarial environment.
Yeah. Good problem to have.
Yeah.
Bitcoin is catching on.
And numbers certainly going up, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, numbers certainly going up. I hope on-chain ownership is going up too, but it's hard to say. You can't measure that, right?
Yeah. I hope so too. It's great to catch up. We got to do it more often.
Definitely, man. Yeah, I always love coming on. And it's always good talking about this stuff. I hope I'm not... Well, I guess I should be scaring people a little bit. It's not my intent to, like, muckrake, but...
No, I think it's very important. Like, again, going back to the, it does seem clear to me now at this point. It was great being at Bitcoin Plus Plus. It made me feel... Like I said, I go to Bit Devs. I probably catch Bit Devs here, like, every other month in Austin. Not going as often as I did in New York, just family stuff and busy.
Yeah.
But being at Bitcoin Plus Plus around that group of people, it made me feel like I was back in New York, like 2015 to 2018 era, like Bit Devs, like conversations, and really immersing myself in the technical details in a way that I haven't in some time. And I think that's another thing. It's weird, like, this position, and I'm not on the media side of things. It's like, I think I have PTSD from SegWit and Taproot too, due to the unforeseen sort of consequences of those two merges, and being a big champion of both of them. And I've been apprehensive to, like, get into the conversation about any of these upgrades. It's like, what do I know? I can't audit the code. I can't verify it. Like,
and that position is almost more admirable than just jumping in and kind of blindly saying, you know, yeah, let's do X, let's do Y. So I think there's a nobility in that. It's tough. We've got to start having discussions about this stuff. But I think you're doing a great job. You know, TFTC was the first Bitcoin podcast I ever appeared on. So every time I come back, it feels like coming home.
Beefy Bitcoin boys, you know?
That's right. That's right. That's right. You're going to have to do a Will O'Byrne episode at some point.
How is Will? I haven't talked to him in a while.
You gotta dig him up, check in.
I know. We'll do it. Hopefully we do it in person. We get all three of us back together. Get the beefy Bitcoin boys back together.
That'd be fun, but we have to do it at the, maybe not at the Barstool office, but.
Maybe we can do it at PubKey DC.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
That'd be very fun.
Get all of us there.
Let's plan on it.
I'll be in that neck of the woods relatively soon, so.
Excited for that.
Yeah, I am as well. I think I like the part... I like that you're playing heel too. I don't think you want to be playing heel, but I think forcing people to think about these problems from different perspectives is important.
I have to admit, I am a contrarian by nature, so indulging in that is always a little bit fun. But yeah, look, man, there's got to be somebody to kind of bridge the worlds and be a credible counterweight, because it's very echo chambery. It's more echo chambery than it should be, I think.
Yeah.
So I'll keep doing my heel job as long as it needs doing.
Hopefully we don't need it for too long.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. I agree. But we didn't even get to talk about block space, so we'll have to do that, or block size. So we'll do that on a future episode.
Yeah, we'll do that another time. That's a big one. I gotta prep for that one.
Definitely. Definitely.
All right. Keep crushing it, brother.
Thanks, my man. Thanks for having me.
Peace and love, freaks. Freaks, thank you for listening to the show. I hope you liked it. If you did like it, please make sure you subscribe, rate, review the show. It helps us out a lot. And also, if you like these conversations, I've come to realize that many people listen to the podcast. They don't know we have another sort of layer of this media company. We have the newsletter, the Bitcoin Brief. Go to tftc.io. Make sure you subscribe there. A lot of the topics that are discussed on this podcast, I write about 5 days a week in the newsletter. We also have the TFTC Elite tier. If you sign up for that, become a member. We have a private Discord server for the elite freaks out there, where we're dropping ad-free versions of this show and having discussions. about everything we talk about. A day early. Logan wanted me to make sure if you want to get the show a day early, become a TFTC elite member, you will get that. We have our Discord server. Right now it's conversation between myself and TFTC elite tier members, but we're going to expand that. We'll probably do closed Q&As with people in the industry. I may be doing Macro Mondays. So join us. Go to tftc.io. Subscribe. Find the button in the top right corner of the website. Become a TFTC elite member. Thank you for joining us. Okay.